You're listening to St. Pete X. Today's episode is brought to you by Cityverse. Cityverse brings the community together on a new civic platform powered by Catalyst News. St. Pete Cityverse is launching soon. You can learn more and reserve your home space at cityverse.life. Now, enjoy the conversation. Joining me today on SPX, somewhat reluctantly, is the Venerable Waveney and Moore. Welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
So I'm going to get the for me personally, bad news out of the way first. One of the reasons we're having this conversation today is because you are going to retire from writing soon.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
yes.
Many years of service with the Times and with us most recently, and it's been so wonderful to work with you over the last year plus or so. You brought so much to the Catalyst, and I appreciate it beyond words. Really, just lovely to have you involved.
Well, thank you. You know, this really helped me writing for the Catalyst because it was different kind of writing, and I was really appreciate your inviting me to do this because it stretched me a little in my old age. you allowed me to voice my opinion, to talk and write about what I thought was interesting, which was different after decades of writing for a newspaper, which was much more regulated, much more objective. So thank you. And I have to tell you, my husband's been telling everybody for the past couple of years since I retired from the Times that I failed retirement. So now I'm not going to fail retirement.
Actually,
really.
Going to change gears and
relax a little.
And relax a little bit.
Yes.
That's wonderful. Well, let's talk a little bit about how it all started. How did journalism come into your life? What made you need to cover things?
Well, it was really, I went to college in New York, a small Catholic college, College of New Rochelle, which is unfortunately no more because it was some sort of a financial scandal. And I took journalism classes at Iona College because it was, you know, closely associated with Iona College. And then I didn't get into journalism immediately, but when we moved to Kansas, I was invited to be a news clerk for the Kansas City Star, which, by the way, which really dates me because it was an afternoon paper. Do you know any that exists? So I started out as a news clerk and then began reporting. And wonderful editor, John Wiley, who then went on to buy his own newspaper in Ooliga, Oklahoma. But he was a wonderful mentor, and I started there. When we moved to St. Pete, I couldn't get on to the Times. It was around the same time that the Times was doing away with its afternoon paper, the Evening Independent. So I went to work for a trade magazine, food trade magazine in Clearwater. Actually, they had two. And, you know, I liked it. It was all right, but I wanted to get back into regular, quote-unquote, journalism. What was good about the trade magazine was that I was able to do travel to Europe.
That's pretty good.
Yes, that was very good. And around the United States, you know, covering food shows, that sort of thing. So that was good. And then I think somebody my daughter was babysitting for worked for the Times. and suggested that I apply, and I did, and I started freelancing doing food, a food column, and eventually I got onto Neighborhood Times, which was very, very hyper-local news, and of course, that's no more, but at one point, I think the Times had about 7 sections, as I said, Clearwater, Force and Pete sections. And it was wonderful. People liked it. But do you know what's happened with newspapers?
Well, we'll definitely get into that. But before we do, when you started in Kansas City, were you, what was the draw? Was it the craft of journalism? Was it the, the action in the city and caring about getting information out to as many people or influence in the city, or, what was your driver to keep pushing down this road?
At that time, I wouldn't say my goals were that lofty. Yeah. I have to be honest, I always liked to write. And so that was great and I enjoyed it. And then what I did enjoy and continue to enjoy is meeting people. Being a journalist has allowed me to meet so many wonderful people, tell their stories, hear their stories. Not everybody has been nice, but, you sort of learn to be more accepting of people because you see so many people, you hear them, you hear their stories. And, we can get into such a rut if you don't meet people unlike yourself. And so I've enjoyed it, ordinary people who are important, people who think they're important, and just telling those stories, I think that's been important to me.
And as you kind of look at the landscape of those stories, you mentioned people who think they're important, stories that don't get told, stories that get told too much. How is the stepping back and looking at power flowing through a city? How imbalanced is it where a few people control so much of the narrative and, so many people have no real impact on the narrative? Was that sort of scale pretty evident to you as you worked?
I would say so, because a lot of the stories, I think, weren't told. And as I said, I have to go back to Neighborhood Times. I think that helped to tell the stories of people who normally would have been ignored. I know at one point in Neighborhood Times, there was a column that focused on the African-American community. I mean, that did not last very long, as I recall. But that was good. And then, those stories began to be told within the paper. And I think that was important to tell the stories. And as you know, one of my pet peeves is, and I'm branching off here, the whole South St. Pete.
Mm-hmm. Calling it Southside?
Yes, yeah. And South St. Pete and Southside. And I've always felt that that's been somewhat disparaging. Mm-hmm. And I never say South St. Pete. I never say Southside unless it's within a quote or, like the South St. Pete CRA. So I think those stories weren't being told unless, it was on a radio station or TV or even in one of the local newspapers. You saw there was a crime and South St. Pete, it happened elsewhere. There's no mention of where that happened. But I do think that's changed. I do think that there is more emphasis in telling everyone's stories. I don't know if I answered your question.
You did. Well, listen, I'd like to, you know, and I know you wrote a piece about this for us, about the using Southside as a term. Let's dig in a little more. You know, first, just sort of as a juxtaposition, is there a place that as we get more equity and more success in certain areas that it could become a neighborhood like the Warehouse Arts District and have its own positive cachet around it? Or at that point, does it represent something bigger and maybe not as pleasant that it's better just to move on and look at the individual neighbors themselves? Or said another way, can we dig a little bit into why you think that that is a problem?
Well, it's possible. I think everybody has tried to do something different. The mayors have tried to, you know, name a particular area, and again, Southside or South St. Pete typically, I think, represented an area of this southern part of the city. I think that it's possible that it could just be the north side, just like the north side. And how many people know that the south side, there is, quote unquote, there is Bahama Shores, there are the pink streets, and you hear people refer to people who live there say the pink streets. They don't say they live on the south side or South St. Pete.
And perhaps therein lies the problem, because it isn't actually referring to a geographical area. Mm-hmm. It's referring to a group of people.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So with that, you know, having this awareness, and obviously having an awareness that your stories can influence things, you know, that's where I get into, you know, when does it move from, you know, how do you, just as a human who cares about the community she lives in, you know that the injustice is there. You know that you, with your words, can help that a little bit. And so how much does the work shift? How can it not shift, really, to you know, to that being a big part of it? You know, seeing the impact you can literally have with the stroke of a pen or the press of a keyboard. So how did that change for you as you, you know, got to have a bigger and bigger voice in the community?
Mm-hmm. Well, it changed in, you know, being able to say to your editor, you know, I don't think that's a good idea, or I don't think that, or just to maybe hint that, you know, maybe that approach isn't that great. And I'm going to move away a little bit from race and so on. I remember a few years back, there was a headline in the Times that talked about an elderly man. And being the first to go to, I can't remember if it was Chick-fil-A or one of those places that was just opening. And so I read it, and then I cringed, because this elderly man was at least 2 years younger than I. So, you know, those are things I might joke about and say, and, you know, it might help somebody to be aware that, you know, sort of be careful of how you approach things. You know, if you saw all the, and that's, you know, the Times and many other places have dropped mug shots. When you look at a list of mug shots and you just saw black faces, you know. So I do think that people are becoming more conscious of how they approach things. I think leaders are. And, of course, this is historic. We have a black mayor, and something which is you have to marvel about in a city that once had the KKK marching through the streets, people in leadership positions. You know, I have to be positive and look at things like that and think, this is wonderful. This means that not everybody's thinking the same as before, even though there's so much turmoil in the country. People are speaking out and doing what they believe is right.
And so, you know, as you look at sort of the, you know, the mechanics of a city, and you've reported on money flowing or opportunity flowing, any observations that you have of things that have maybe gone better than you expected, or things that are still lagging behind where they could be, you know, whether it be education or anything else that, that jumps out at you?
Such a difficult question, because one does wonder why certain areas still are undeveloped. Why is 4th Street North
booming
and other areas are not? Why is it taking such a long time for 22nd Street South to boom? 16th Street, where trees were planted, people were promised that traffic from Tropicana Field was going to go south, and people were going to go into the neighborhoods and shop at businesses. You sort of wonder, well, why hasn't that really happened? I've noticed that some of the, you know, the crosswalks, the solar activated crosswalks, to me, it took a long time to go south. I could be wrong, you know, but that was just my observation. So I think things need to definitely continue to focus there. The Tangerine Plaza, the supermarket, why is it that a Publix is not interested, maybe? Why do people have to jump on a bus to get to a decent supermarket?
Yeah.
And then when a supermarket closes, you hear all these rumors that it was because people were shoplifting. You know, and nobody beats that down. So there definitely needs to be focus. And I have to say that, to me, every mayor has tried.
Yeah.
But, you know, two large supermarkets closed there, and there's nothing there now.
It's amazing. I think there are, where I live, 8 supermarkets within literally 2 miles. And it's just, yeah.
Yeah, I live within 2 supermarkets. I mean, 2 Publix,
yeah.
You know, and you think, okay. But I try to, and again, I've become strategic. I make sure most of the time I go to the Publix nearer to me, mm-hmm. because I keep saying, telling my husband, I want to keep it open.
Right.
By myself.
Yeah, that's a lot of subs to eat. So, you know, part of the, you know, the underlying result of systemic racism is that the developers and the people who have the money to develop the areas for certain constituents or have historically been white. And therefore that's, you know, 4th Street North, you know, makes in their minds sense, to do that. So as we look at the, and, you know, I hate, it's always a little awkward to say the white community and the black community, all communities have leaders, and that could be around a religion or an ethnicity or a geography. So if we were to look at, you know, but certainly with racism, the black community needed leaders to represent black folks to help combat racism, right? And take that effort, you know, to take that on. So, you know, when you look at the leadership in that regard, and then, you know, that leadership as, you know, progress was made, turning to being involved in politics, starting to do some development, you know, Sankofa is a good example of something that's on the, you know, on the come here. What are your observations of the evolution over the last 20 years or so of that sort of group in working from that end of things to, you know, make things better?
Well, I think definitely, you know, you've seen progress with that. You see Pastor Louis Murphy's church and, you know, his congregation trying to improve the neighborhoods around them. You know, of course, he's involved with the Sugar Hill project for Tropicana development. I think you see a lot of the pastors. To me, they have been working on that. And I think Pastor Murphy was also, and other leaders were also involved with the Manhattan Casino.
Somewhat unique to the African-American community that the pastors, you know, have that role, which is a different, you know, they're a different presence than a wealthy developer or a...
Yes. Yes, definitely. But these are the leaders, you know, people respect them. They've been able to go to the administrations and represent people and talk and point out injustices. It hasn't necessarily worked all the time, but I do think that without those leaders, there wouldn't have been progress. You know, people have to, I hate this word, but I'm gonna, this phrase, you know, speak truth to power. Mm-hmm. But those are the people that maybe the quote unquote white community looks to speak on behalf of the rest of the community. I think that might probably change because I don't know if the younger people are necessarily church going, right, and turning to pastors. I think the younger people are advocating for themselves. You know, when you see the tenant unions, when you see other actions, you know, when you see the people who got together to try to save the Manhattan Casino. So I think they've played a role, you know, religious leaders, but I think that the younger people are now going to be more advocates for the community.
Which, I mean, theoretically, if we're not thinking about it as one or, but one and, mm-hmm, that's a positive, mm-hmm, and perhaps something that wouldn't have been as easy to accomplish 20 years ago.
Yes, and they're running for office.
Yeah,
you know, so they are getting into politics more. That's probably going to help.
And so, you know, obviously, we talked a little bit about one of the roles of the Fourth Estate is a little bit of objective truth to power. And you were a finalist for a Pulitzer for your work in investigative journalism. That was wonderful. And let's talk about that. Let's celebrate, mm-hmm, that for a moment. How was that experience?
Oh, that was wonderful. Actually, I was a finalist in two projects, one with a number of us, including Dave Barstow, who went on to the New York Times and won, I think, two Pulitzers. But yes, one was the Reverend Henry Lyons, who went to prison for, financial corruption with the National Baptist Organization. And the other was a Dozier school in Marianna. I worked with Ben Montgomery on that. That was, it was grueling, you know, because I do remember trying to manage my Neighborhood Times editor's expectations, you know, of local news, feeding the beast, and then also trying to work on this other project. But everyone was supportive. It's, you know, it meant going up to Marianna several times. That was unique because I'd not gone into that part of the state before. There was a lot of antagonism. You know, that school was people, you know, it was the livelihood of the town. And it, you know, it was sad. Interviewing some of the men who were so traumatized as boys at that reform school, quote unquote, and treated so badly. We, you know, I don't know how many people actually die or killed because of that. And that was a good experience. It was a good experience. And the Lions was also good, though it was sort of difficult again, being I was the only Black reporter in that group, sort of writing about this Black pastor who was a hero in St. Pete at one point. Someone who everyone looked up to.
Journalists with an ideally objective mindset, what was the experience being the only Black journalist reporting on a Black icon amongst another, a group of white journalists?
Well, it was a little difficult. I have to say it gave me access that the others didn't have, because I became invisible among the Black community. I didn't stand out a lot because a lot of other people were chasing the same story. But, I could listen to things that maybe people would talk around me because, I looked like them and they wouldn't necessarily think of me as a reporter.
And then for you, then the actual writing itself, did that go smoothly, given that you were, was it just about the story, or were there elements of it, the overlay of race that made it interesting for you to work and write together with that group?
The writing went smoothly because we each contributed, and I don't know that race played a part in the writing, except, as I said, this was someone who was respected in the community. I mean, there was another story that I did, and someone said to me, I won't go into details, you're Black first.
Yeah. And that was my next question. So then after that story came out, did it change your, was there more awareness of your presence? Were you, it's bittersweet, right? Because it's someone who was respected, but it was also true. Mm-hmm. And so the story needed to be told. Mm-hmm. But that also then had some negative, ramifications on a community that was already, mm-hmm. Working hard to move forward. So what was mm-hmm. life for you like after the story came out?
What happened, I think, after that, because I covered religion as well. That was one of my beats, and I really enjoyed that. I got a call at home once, and that's when the first time I changed my home number from a person who said to me, this was very early in the morning, I think it was, you are, everybody's saying you're trying to bring down Black pastors. And it's silly now that I changed my number, but it sort of rattled me a little. And it just happened to be that certain people started calling me about some of the things that were going on. And these were Black people in Black congregations.
Because they still need the same truth told as anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So how, conflicting emotions as far as journalist, yes, member of the community, tougher? How did taking on that role and having people see you as someone to come to for these things mm-hmm. change your existence?
Well, it did make it a little uncomfortable for me. And I still think sometimes, I'm not sure how people regard me. I don't know, because it might have been someone's pastor that I wrote something negative about.
And while I love what we've built at the Catalyst, I know the Achilles heel of that is our lack of resources to do investigative reporting. We've tried to come at it from as a solutions-based publications with, you know, trying to be positive and trying to say there are problems. Let's talk about these problems in ways, or be a catalyst for talking about these problems in ways that lead to solutions. But, you know, do we have the wherewithal or resources, or does it fit our mission to go do the Dozier Boys School story? Probably not. And that reporting needs to be done. Absolutely. So as you know, it's been harder and harder to get those types of stories, and you know, the general resources have been drained away. How have you seen the community change, how leaders' behavior changes without enough people watching?
Yeah, I've wondered about that, about the smaller, quote-unquote smaller things that are not being covered. But I do think that I've seen, you know, stories that have been done that show that people are watching. I mean, probably not everything, but I think it's important, even if one piece is done every once a month, it keeps those leaders on their toes. And I think that's one of the reasons people like the Catalyst, is because there is so much local news, you know. Nothing is too little or unimportant. And the larger organizations don't have those resources. You can't hire that many people. I mean, Gannett just laid off a whole bunch of people. It's getting tougher and tougher because I think everybody, you know, my nephew came to help us set up our smart TV, which is much smarter than we are. And he said, well, you know, I don't look at TV. And I know he doesn't read a newspaper either. And he looks at his phone and whatever is interesting. So we're battling a lot because the younger people aren't necessarily reading the newspaper. They're reading whatever feed they're interested in. So I sort of wonder what happens next. And as you said, you're wondering, what about the leaders? How do you keep them on their toes? How do you make sure that they know that somebody's watching? You know, to cover City Hall, that takes a lot of resources. I mean, those meetings go on forever.
And on.
Yes. And there's so many stories, mm-hmm. in just that, in one meeting, or all the commission meetings. There's so many things, and you've just got to pick one and run with it.
Yeah. And you know, that begs the question. I think, you know, part of that, the audience moving away is because social media offered amongst other addictive negative things, but it did offer a more interactive experience with content, mm-hmm. and it let people, and especially now, I think there's more of a demand for expertise because, you know, the internet has brought endless and infinite information to us. And so if you're into something, you can really get into it, mm-hmm. in a way and know about it. Mm-hmm. And that makes it harder for a journalist that's, you know, doing a couple stories a day to get to the depth that, you know, people who care about that subject matter expect, mm-hmm. which then, you know, is where I don't think citizen journalists are right, but crowdsourcing this knowledge and this awareness. And, you know, every phone has a camera, everybody, you know, has distribution now. And so it begs the question, is there a way to, you know, leverage the community to almost understand, can the community value journalism principles, objectivity, or, you know, the basics of fact collecting and things like that? And, you know, is crowdsourcing news where the future's going? I mean, obviously building Cityverse, I think that it is, mm-hmm. But again, you know, the thing that just nags is that you still don't get that objective, truth-driven, mm-hmm. deep dive into things that require resources. I mean, mm-hmm. it's nice to go down to city council if you're into that sort of thing and, you know, do some tweets and do some stuff. But then you're going out with your friends later. You're not driving up to the school day after day after day. And
exactly.
And that's the thing I fear, that we lose.
Yeah,
we can find a way to fund it.
Yeah, we are losing some of that unless you, I mean, as you said, unless you're absolutely focused on something or looking, you know, like I might look at a school board meeting and think, how interesting, this is so interesting. But how many people are doing that? And you miss all the craziness that happens, you know.
I have to make it to a reality show.
Yes.
Well, I, you know, just want to celebrate. You've had such a wonderful career. Obviously, the Pulitzers were we'll say, stones, gems in the crown of your career.
Finalists.
Should have won. Well, okay. We'll have a talk with those folks.
I'm pleased just to have been in that category.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Much deserved. And what else sort of flavors your memory of your 25 mm-hmm. or 24 years at the Times? And
I think definitely, and I keep saying the people that I met and what I have learned. I've learned a whole lot. As you know, I didn't grow up in the United States or so on, and this has just it just helped me enormously to learn. I mean, it's just like I keep telling people, I went to work at McDonald's when I was in college. I'd just come to the United States and I learned so much. I mean, about people, about just counting the currency, you know. And so that I use that to say that I learned so much going out to live in Kansas and work in the Kansas City area here in St. Petersburg. I mean, writing what you asked me to write, you know, to focus on equity issues, that was important because I learned a lot about the African-American community that I thought I knew and I didn't. I learned a lot more and I was able to focus on other minorities. That, you know, the fact that there was all this anti-Asian hate, I felt honored to be able to write about the Holocaust Museum as it developed, as it moved from Madeira Beach to St. Pete, and to tell the stories of some of the survivors, because so many people don't know, you know, to talk to people who, after the riots in 1996, to go into the neighborhood and talk to people who said, you know, and we weren't really hearing this. We didn't agree. We don't agree with that sort of thing. And these were people who had made a living. Their husbands, maybe they were widows. Their husbands had worked for a sanitation department or something in the city. And they lived, they had their own homes. And, you know, they were terrified of all of the violence that occurred. So I think it was definitely the people that I met and the things that I learned. That's what I value. And I probably am not expressing it properly, but, you know, it was good to learn about people and I learned about different faiths. And to respect what people believed and to respect people who don't believe. And to know that, you know, everybody is sort of searching for an answer and trying to do their best. To me, it sounds trite, but it's true.
And so given that, you know, you kind of went a couple different sides of the spectrum of positive and negative with all of that. And in general, you're decades of living in St. Pete's, where are you, what are you optimistic or are you pessimistic right now?
I'm optimistic. Probably I shouldn't say I am optimistic, but I'm also very curious. to see where things are going. You know, just I come downtown less, but I marvel at what's going on in the city. I mean, it does make me a little uncomfortable sometimes, though, that, you know, the city has changed. But, you know, when I moved here, you know, Tampa was the place. And now, you know, St. Petersburg is still growing. I feel optimistic about it. I am curious to see what happens with the stadium. I'm curious to see what will happen if Mayor Welch will get the second term. I can say that out loud. Sure. I'm looking at the school district. Curious to see what's happening there. There are changes, but I think people are engaged.
Well, I think that's a lot. If the people are engaged, I think that's winning. Well, thank you again. It really was a privilege to have someone of your skill level and pedigree, willing to jump in for our little experiment. It just made us feel a little grown up, which was nice. And it was very much appreciated. And of course, I think you have just another couple of columns left, but obviously whenever anything needs to be written, you will always have a place to get it out to the community through us. And much appreciation.
Joe, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. It really helped my growth. And, you know, you can't stop growing, but I am retiring.
Waveney and Moore, retired. Thank you.
Thank you.